So I don't know what it is about the drinking water in Hamburg, but everybody's just rocking out with the lightning talks. So first up, and I'm pretty much gonna throw to Rainier almost instantly. Am I still in? Okay. Okay, great. Yep, right at 12:45, which we're right at now. This Rainier's talk, I messed it up yesterday. I messed up Rainier's original 5-minute lightning talk yesterday. And he had more content than he could fit in 5 minutes anyway. And I messed up the slides, so I felt a little bit guilty about that. So I decided the only fair thing to do was to give him 10 minutes today. So Rainier's going to take it off with the first talk. 10 minutes today, give him a huge round of applause, and stay tuned for a great show.
Well, first of all, thank you, Nick, for being so kind to me. I love you, really. Well, as you probably have seen in the newspapers there, especially in the past year, there are lots of patent wars going on, especially in the smartphone field, and it's typically Apple and Apple and Samsung and Apple again. And this picture gives a fine overview of some of these things. I actually chose the most colorful picture I could find on the internet. There are many of them, and I'm not prepared to discuss them all in detail. But there are lots of fight. Keep that in mind. Well, is this a matter of people, nasty, miserable Korean people stealing Bill Gates' brilliant Steve Jobs' brilliant inventions? No, it's really a thing which is called, slide please. It's something called strategic patenting, which is a phenomenon known for a long time in the literature. And to make things real simple, the practice is as follows. If you're a party in this industry, get a zillion patents, trivial patents, it doesn't matter. And the first thing you can do is to eat your competitor by harassing him with these patents. And the other thing is get a huge patent portfolio to prevent to be eaten. So it really boils down to an arms race. And and eventually it's like a nuclear war arms race. Mutual destruction, these words are used in the literature. And the net effect of this practice is, well, it has no effect to innovation whatsoever. You may remember the American Constitution says that the patents should foster innovation, basically. They don't. It's just a costly arms race, which is bad for everyone, except patent attorneys, perhaps. Well, some background about patents. Well, these, as I said, patents in this case don't foster innovation. There is literature saying, well, actually, they don't do in any field, patents cost more money than they provide money, except in medicine. But in medicine, it has been proven that they don't foster innovation, that innovation is actually hampered by these patents. It's a nice literature about it. And then patents are associated with protection, Schutz of the in German. And protection sounds like something desirable, but protection is actually alien, contrary to the idea of a free market. Could we do something about it? Well, from the legal part, is there any room to move? Well, basically, there is. I don't dive in details. And basically, slide. Yeah, okay, it's on this slide. So basically, you should be aware that patents are not a matter of legal logic or any way. It's commercial policy. That's what the central thing is. And it's, for instance, the Chinese are very much aware of that. Lawyers complain about the Chinese, but the Chinese don't do the only sensible thing. They pursue their own interests. Well, could we do anything to stop these patent wars? Well, actually, the risk is that they are contagious and that the virus may spread from the United States, where this practice is really strong these days, to Europe. Because for 40 years, they have been working on a central European patent court, and it sounds illogical that we don't have it, but it's actually a very dangerous thing, and the preparations are now in the final stage. Van Rompuy made a decision actually to establish it, and it has been approved. And it aims, well, this central court, it sounds logically, but it aims at simplification, at cost reduction, but actually it has already been proven in literature that it will be very expensive and it will be very complicated, and it won't be... Oh, I forgot to say slide again. So the preparations are in the final stage. And it won't be good for EU competitiveness because, and that's a very simple thing, the graph shows, and if it's good, yeah, it moves indeed. It's a GIF, an old-fashioned GIF, and it moves, and it shows that the bottom dark blue part are the number of European patents owned by Europeans, because that's often a confusion. European patents are patents in Europe, are not patents owned by Europeans. And actually, less than half and a decreasing part of European patents is owned by Europeans. So it has nothing to do with European competitiveness. And another thing is that, this new court will make things more competitive, more costly, and that will be especially detrimental to SMEs, small and medium enterprises. And there is a larger percentage of these companies in Europe than there is in the United States. So that's another reason why it will be detrimental to Europe. If this court materializes and it's 5 before 12, then there will be a kind of one-stop shopping to extend U.S. patent wars to Europe. It's already happening, but it's now, on a moderate scale because it's still divided over the individual countries. And another thing to mention briefly is that this centralized court in the United States, there is a centralized patent court since 1982, and the people who are the judges that on that court, they are all proper judges and objective, but they all love patents. They are crazy about patents, and they are addicted to patents, so they're not really objective, which they are supposed to be. Slide. Is this really over now that Van Rompuy and the European Council made this decision? No, it's not. There are lots of complaints, and even large companies like Nokia and Ericsson, they start complaining that this is this setup. It looks logical, but it isn't at all, and it will be, as I said, costly, complicated. Max Planck Institute in Munich prepared report saying it's a ridiculous thing to do, and you'll find the documentation on this URL. And I would like to mention the name here of a person called Gérald Cédrati-Dinet, also known as Gibbous. And he's very active in this field. So watch this website and see what you can do about it. My own address is at the bottom. My experience is, and I wrote a PhD on patent law, and especially on this patent fights and things like that. So my name is on the bottom. And that's my story. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And just because we have such a compressed program, we will not be taking any questions. So if you are done with what your presentation is, then we're just going to move on. Next up, Matthew Borgatti, who I have to download his second set of slides momentarily.
Very fun.
Okay. Awesome.
And I wasn't in the corner making the slides for this talk.
Right now. No, of course not.
I wasn't doing that.
That's not what you were doing at all.
That's not what I was doing. I'm very
And it's
prepared.
Ironic that your talk is motivated misinformation. the talk that you were working on up until about 45 seconds ago.
No, I wasn't doing that.
No. I think you were. I am motivated to provide accurate information, whereas you are motivated to provide inaccurate information.
And I'm motivated to be right.
And I don't know why I'm motivated to delete these words, but
all right.
It happens. It's coming out of your time anyway, so.
Yeah, it does. Oh.
Okay.
So slides auto advance?
If everything works correctly, which hopefully it will.
All right. So.
All right. Oh wait. Hold on. I have to stop. Stop. Okay. Calm yourself.
It's exciting.
I know it's exciting. Na, 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 na. So, you know, that never makes things easier to do. That's the whole point, is to have fun. How many people are... I could actually... You know, I told them I didn't need a herald angel for this session, but it's times like these where I'm like, yeah, maybe I should have... Okay, so Pecha Kucha format, 20 slides, 20 seconds per slide. They advance automatically. If you say slide, I will ignore it. So, Matt, are you ready to go?
Yeah.
Your 6 minutes and 40 seconds starts now.
Groovy. So I'm going to be talking to you about some weird-ass digital fabrication. Essentially, I believe that design is sort of this Middle Endian kind of thing where you have your end goals, you have your initial ideas, and you have the materials, the resources you've got available to fit those two, that you can fit the end goals to fit your materials, you can fit your materials to fit your end goals, that it's this kind of sliding scale. And so there isn't an ideal solution. There isn't some sort of like perfect idealized thing. I mean, there's an ideal solution, and then there's what the universe actually wants to give you. You could do an amazing thing like completely restructure your hackerspace with new furniture and all sorts of awesome things and building out of shipping crates and all that kind of stuff, but you're not going to find it. Because human resources like time, effort, energy, money, they're all finite things. You've only got so much, and you've got to plan your process around what you've got. And so it's similar to programming goals, fitting your amount of time into your amount of programming hours, what bugs you can fix. And so for me, physical object fabrication fits into the same kind of field. I use digital fabrication tools to make sure that I can get a result that I can predict and a method that I can prototype. So when I'm wrong about things, I can correct my wrongness in an iterative and prototype kind of way. So the main goal is getting to a solution that I can get to, getting to a solution that I have a known boundary for. So if the problem is I'm hungry, then making an extensive three-course meal is probably not your ideal solution. That might be the solution to a different problem, like I'm bored. I have too much time on my hands. I want to experiment with new cuisine. I have a family meal coming up and I want to be prepared for it. Like, those are valid goals. Those are valid end goals. But if the question is I'm hungry, the answer is food in face. Like, if I'm making something, if I'm making a project and my answer is I need a working one of these, I can't wander off in the middle and being like, oh, but what's this? Oh, I want to do some wax casting. That's really interesting. No, I have to have a focus. So this project is a prototype for a piece of jewelry. The idea was I only have so much time and so much money, and I also want to create an efficient product that looks professional that I can prototype and iterate, because my initial ideas about what the fit will be, how it will wear, are going to be wrong. So what I did is I designed it in CAD because I can predict a lot of things about how it's going to cast, how the mold's going to get made. And so that's a 3D printed prototype designed to be assembled to fit together. So two casts of that thing in the upper right corner go together once they're cast in metal. And so this whole process is I designed it all in CAD. So laser cut bits to fit together with 3D prototyped bits, silicone cast in it, and it makes a wax mold of something that only cost me $40. This whole process cost me $40 of materials. And the bracelet that it made is a little bit big. Oh no! Another 2 hours of my time and $40, and I've got a prototype that works very, very well for my process. Since it's iterative and since it's made using digital fabrication tools, oh no, my method was wrong. Oh no, I made a mistake. It's really trivial to go back and wind it back and make something that works. I can do it at reasonable cost if I know my method really well and I plan my method around maybe a step in my method's going to be wrong. Let's have it be flexible. So speaking of flexible things, this, I'm working on 3D printed robots, pneumatic soft robots. And that's kind of a difficult problem based on you want to inflate a thing. You want to get a pneumatic thing to inflate. If it has seams, they're going to fight against you. If you have to seal seams, then that's going to be a nightmare. So the process that I and Jim Brett, my collaborator at MIT, have developed is we start with 3D printed powders. We have access to 3D printers. He makes powders for the 3D printers. And what happens is we have water-soluble cores that get printed, insoluble outsides that get printed. We cast the silicone in between them, and then we dissolve out the cores. This is a really early prototype. I've actually got a better one. I'm going to be giving a talk on it tomorrow. But what we can do is we can have a tentacle. We can have a tentacle design where we can do an arbitrary inside and keep the outside the same to get different kinds of motion. it's really trivial for us to make a new design on the inside and print it. So here's an even more complex one that I actually have a working prototype for. So instead of having two different volumes on either side, we have three. But the CAD for this isn't substantially different. It's not super, super different. I didn't have to spend a million hours engineering this, since I already have a method that gets me to a pretty good prototyped result, and the method is pretty solid. I can do things like, I want to print another mold to make a silicone thing with a slight variation off of the last thing that I did. My iteration time's really fast, so this is a mold to make a mold to make a wax thing that goes inside the tentacle. And you'd be like, wow, that's insanely, that's a lot of steps in the process. No, that's actually making some CAD and having a robot hit go. I just ran the 3D printer and then 3D printed part. I cast silicone into it. I get to do other work while that cures. So I even made an alignment jig on the laser cutter because since I have it in CAD, since it's all 3D and I know exact measurements for it, for aligning the internals of the robot, I can just 3D print, laser cut, I can make alignment jigs, make my life easier through robots. So go boldly forward. Make things. Do stuff. With a knowledge of the kind of resources you have, including your own time. Things are going to screw up in your methods. That's just guaranteed. New stuff has a higher chance of screw-ups, but you can't rely on, well, eventually I'm going to figure out the screw-ups. You know, no matter where I pursue, explosions happen, so what? You can actually plan a method where if I have a step in my method that's wrong, I can have a flexible enough method that no matter what, it's going to work. So here is something that I got wrong the first time, making it way too complicated, and got right the second time. So the first time I was like, oh, clever laser cutting thing, I'm gonna make a mold to cast a stamp into. And so there's a Chinese restaurant near me. It has the weirdest logo ever. It's just an assemblage of clip art that kind of looks like a chef guy. And so I thought he needed a gun. So the first method was, oh my God, complicated, blah, I'm gonna cast my own stamp. Over time, I looked on the internet and I looked up laser cut stamp, and there's actually laser cut stamp rubber. I could just put it on the laser. So the thing is, sometimes you get complicated.
That's it. You're done.
Bye.
All right.
But that's also okay because you're giving the next talk.
Talk number two. This isn't the one I was working on in the corner over there, no.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Okay, and Matt, just one quick note.
Yeah.
Don't forget, you want to make sure that you don't walk.
Oh, right, yeah, I have a habit of wandering. Sorry,
yeah. If it helps you, you can always just stand like this, and then when you want to see if anybody is about to throw something at you in the audience, you just turn out like that.
Okay.
Looking at slides, paranoid. Looking at slides, paranoid.
All right. Okay.
Good? Okay,
yes.
Go.
So this is a little talk just about, since I own a small company, a lot of my time has been spent finding out what kind of advertising works. And I found a lot of kind of mildly terrifying to extremely terrifying things that go on in the world of advertising. So specifically, motivated misinformation is the general idea that there are reasons to tell people things that aren't true. Oh my God, who realized? But that there are actually tools out there in the world, expensive digital tools and simple little social tools that allow you to change what people think about facts. So this particular talk is going to go, I'm going to tell you depressing things, and then I'm going to show you a kitten. So let's all go down the rabbit hole and put on our tinfoil hats and enjoy some kittens. So I'm going to start out with a story just kind of to establish how powerful misinformation can be about polio. So in Afghanistan, there was the highest rate of polio anywhere in the world, a whopping 50-something cases as opposed to the rest of the world combines 250-something. 58 cases of a disease that the World Health Organization considers eradicated. So it's not at a level where you can have epidemic size outbreaks without some amazing social thing happening to stop people from having immunity. So cases have been steadily increasing since the 60s in tandem with a set of religious beliefs. So what has ended up happening is there are a number of people who believe that the polio vaccination campaign is a Western conspiracy to emasculate them. And so there are a number of people who pamphlet various neighborhoods in Afghanistan saying, be suspicious of people giving out polio vaccines. Kitten. So this isn't magic satellites are changing your brain. This is a measurable increase, a wild increase in polio outbreaks. This is measurable. You can also find the pamphlets that they're being handed out. And surely, we're suspicious and scientific people. We cannot be subject to this brand of misinformation. So there are actually systems that are pretty much designed to advertise to you, to convince you about the nature of the world. And they're reasonably sophisticated. Google AdWords has a reasonable idea of what you like. So there's a service called Help a Reporter Out, where lazy reporters and people who want to appear in the news meet over a pay service. So Help a Reporter Out, essentially lots of people get paid by the word or by the view, and they need last-minute news. There are lots of people who want a story written about them that are willing to give an interview on any topic, whether an expert or not, and it will come out in the news. Kitten! I know this because I am a member of Help a Reporter Out because it's good advertisement for my company. So I give interviews on pretty much any subject that people ask me about, and people will cite me as an expert in their story. Advertising equivalent exposure is another term used in advertising for a news story that is as good as an ad. So there are lots of ad agencies that produce things that sound a lot like news, like scientists have found the perfect formula for a butt. This is an actual story that was on Fox News, and... You can purchase news exposure. It was a set of advertisers who went to a university with, here's a result we want, is there any mathematical foundation behind it? And they just gave them a vague, hand-wavy answer. And the PR company said, hey, this is backed up by academics. There are robust systems for doing this. This is a known problem. This happens, unfortunately, all the time in things like medicines, where you will have a company that wants people to feel a certain thing about a medicine. They don't have to actually say it, but what they can do is contact reporters with PR pieces to talk about how good the medicine is. There was actually a recent pharma company that was sued because on one page they would have an advertisement that had no particular medical claims, and on the other page there would be an editorial piece with someone saying, I took this medicine and it cured all my diseases. So, there's a book called Trust Me, I'm Lying, if you're interested in this topic. It was written by the ad executive of American Apparel, and... it actually goes over a lot of the techniques for drifting news away from news stories and into news sensationalism. Essentially, things that catch eyes, things that catch ears, make news. And so one of the kind of core tactics that the author of Trust Me, I'm Lying talks about again and again is, kitten, is you go up the chain. You can turn little stories into big stories by establishing a framework of small stories so that when someone Googles something, researching a story last minute on a deadline, that they will find the spectrum of your existing stories. Essentially, you can pepper local media outlets with the thing you want people to say. So, what can we do? Blogs. So, essentially, there are a lot of ways that blogs, independently written things, can be terrible and awful, but they can also be vetted. So you can start being aware of the kind of people who do their research and check up on their research, people who use open research, people who use research that actually has a medical foundation, or you can check their sources, you can find their facts, you can check their hyperlinks and decide for yourself. So there are some people who do amazing blog work and who do amazing, essentially skeptical reporting on the news. And they essentially are subject to the same forces that make for good stories in science. They're vetted, there's open review, there's peer review. You can look at them. And so one person that's wonderful to watch, I recommend you follow his blog, Edzard Ernst is actually the first UK professor of alternative medicine, and he publishes articles on what alternative medicines don't work at all. He is a professor of alternative medicine that spends most of his time publishing peer-reviewed articles on how alternative medicine doesn't work. This is a good guy to watch. Also, Ben Goldacre. Kitten. I recommend Ben Goldacre's Bad Science. He's a columnist for The Guardian, and he writes about pretty much how this kind of stuff happens. Media misreporting.
Last kitten, I mean slide.
Kitten. So, thank you very much. Go out there, be suspicious, tinfoil hats.
All right, Hugo, are you ready? Hugo? Yep, okay, just jump right up there. Okay, and David, you emailed. Are your slides here, David? Oh, okay. Did you just email me those slides? Maybe. Yep. Okay. I am confusing myself here. Okay, so Hugo, you're up. David, you're next. This is the Lightning Talks. We've got plenty of seats over here, and we've got a really compressed program, and we're 1 minute behind, so we're just going to jump right into it, and your 6 minutes and 40-second Pecha Kucha talk starts now.
Okay, so hello, everybody. I'm Hugo. I'm going to talk about Terms of Service Didn't Treat, which is a project I started this summer with people from Hønested. I'm also a law student, and so I'm going to talk about the problem, problem which affects a lot of people who use the web every day, and I think that with some hacking, we can pretty much fix it. So the problem is the biggest lie on the web. This lie is I have read and agree to the terms of service. So, of course, I'm talking about web services which deal with our private data and our creative material. What is at stake is our rights and our freedoms on the web and pretty much those of everybody else. So, yeah, the process of acceptance is basically broken. This is a screenshot from some iPhone application. The problem is that legally this is contract, and contracts are based on agreements. There is no real agreement, as you can see, because the real problem is that we never read that stuff, and we actually give up some of our rights without noticing. This can be pretty extreme, like this website. People didn't read it, and they actually sold their soul to a game station, which is a game website. Okay, so this may be a prank, but sometimes it can get serious. It was a topic from US researchers, and they found out that it would take every person 76 days every year to be able to read all the terms they agree to online. So basically, it requires to be a full-time lawyer to use the web and know what you're dealing with. But it doesn't have to be like that. We solve copyright legal mess with Creative Commons, and in software licensing, we have FSF and OSI labels. The problem is, who's going to fix it for you? Because it's really boring. The terms of service of iTunes are longer than Hamlet, and quite frankly, I prefer to read Hamlet than reading this kind of shit. So what we need is some tools, some organization, and a bit of hacking. One project that I really like is the Mozilla privacy icons, and I would like to mix it with terms of service, didn't you? Icons are pretty cool to convey message, which are easy to understand. And the problem is that there is a very large number of issues that are being dealt with terms of service. It's not as simple as Creative Commons. I mean, simple. Even Creative Commons can get pretty complicated if you have too many icons. But if you have too many icons, it defeats the purpose because it becomes also difficult to understand. This is a database of some of the most common terms that you can find in the terms of service. And you've got about 160 variations. So you cannot do 160 icons, obviously. So this is where Terms of Service Didn't Treat comes in. We try to make easy to understand text summary with icons which are nice to give a balance between what's really bad and what's really good. So it's basically a rating system that we give. The goal is to increase awareness of our rights online and also give people the ability to compare services so we can give a better, we can show people that free software-based alternatives are better than, Facebook or whatever. Of course, the project is free software, so you can fork it and make it about a project, something specific like terms of service about mobile operators or internet services. We also have a browser extension, which I hope you can install. So let's talk a little bit about the content of the terms, that some of the nasty stuff that you can find in those texts. Obviously, copyright is a big issue because a lot of these services deal with our own creative materials, so pictures, text, whatever. Well, if you think about, you know, the goal of copyright, I mean, it's supposed to be the goal. It's to, you know, promote you know, public benefit. And if you look at these terms, there is no public benefit at all. It's only everything is in for the corporations. Nobody really benefits from this. This is the terms of service from Facebook. This is the copyright license in the terms. Basically, it's so broad, it's a bit complicated if you don't understand what each word means, but it's basically, hey, we're Facebook, give us all the rights on your pictures. So we also try to connect some of the different clauses that you can find, and we give thumbs down so that people understand this is bad compared to what other services can do. The other very big issue that we watch is how the terms can change, because in the terms you usually have a part saying something like, oh, okay, we can, you know, anything, anytime, we can change the terms, you won't even be notified. Sometimes you find things like that. So, you know, even if you read the terms one day, maybe in 2 days they have changed and you don't even know about it. So we need to really fix this problem. There's a lot of services to watch. So we've developed a tool which is called Tossback. I mean, actually, we continued the development, which was started by the EFF. And there is Jim who's working on it, and version 3 of Tossback. So Tossback tracks all the terms of service online and make diffs of them, so we can easily watch for the evolution of those. Of course, as usual, it's everything is open data, and the software is on GitHub. If you're interested in helping, I really hope you can contribute. It's also some web development and things like that. Maybe not too exciting for cryptographic hackers or whatever. yeah, so if you, here's my contact address, here's the Twitter of the project, or this is the mailing list where everybody can contribute and say, hey, hello, I was reading the terms of I don't know which service, and I found this thing which was pretty weird, so yeah, what do you think? Thank you.
All right, Christian, you ready? Up next, and then Michelle, here. Oh. Anyone that happens. So, David, you ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay. And your 6 minutes and 40 seconds starts now.
Okay, my name is David Burgess. I'm from a company called Range Networks.
Oh, thank you. If you've heard of OpenBTS, Range Networks is actually the company behind OpenBTS. I'm going to talk about the test network that we ran in Burning Man 2010. And I'm talking too fast. But, you know, what is OpenBTS? OpenBTS is an implementation of the GSM Air interface, but we don't use a conventional GSM core network. We use an all voice over IP core network based on SIP. So it looks like an ordinary UM interface to handsets, but the back end of it looks, you know, your switch can be Asterisk or Free Switch or Yate or something like that. A fully populated OpenBTS network looks something like this. The network architecture is really more similar to IMS, so it allows you to build mixed networks of 2G, 3G, and 4G equipment all on the same core network. There are a lot of cost and operational advantages to doing this for carriers. So the other question, what's Burning Man? Burning Man is an event where about 50,000 people gather on a dry lake bed in the Nevada desert and they build a city. It's a city that's built, built, and run entirely by volunteers, not unlike this Congress in a lot of ways. The culture of Burning Man is really one of volunteerism, self-reliance, participation. It's also a very big hacker and maker event. Most people don't think of Burning Man as a hacker event, but it's probably the biggest hacker event in the world. And there's a huge maker community that comes out to this place. So if you're a hacker or a maker, you should consider going. Okay, why run a test network there? What Burning Man affords us from a radio operating standpoint, it affords us an area of about 10 square kilometers where we can set up full-size towers and run things at full power and pretty much own the environment. Radio propagation follows roughly the hottest suburban model once the city is built out and filled with shipping containers. It also gives us a population of several thousand potential test unit users who have very low expectations. So it's okay if you break things. I mean, a lot of people, if they can make one or two phone calls, they get thrilled and bring you a case of beer. It's, you know, it's just a wonderful, fun place to do this stuff. The participants in this year's networks, again, Range Networks, TIER is a group at UC Berkeley that works on technologies for the developing world. Tropo is a company that builds software for big IVR systems, including systems at Deutsche Telekom. And MedWeb is a telemedicine company based in San Francisco. So these were the companies that actually participated in this network. But of course, Burning Man is violently anti-commercial, so you never use the name of your company openly at Burning Man. Instead, we operate under the name Papa Legba, which is the voodoo Loa who mediates between humanity and the unseen world. And we have the stickers that we put on our phones. It makes them work better. If you actually read the source code, there are actually references to Papa Legba in the source code. We had participants from five countries in our camp this year. Previous years, we've also had participants from Israel and Australia. Burning Man is, there actually is a pretty large international turnout for Burning Man, so you won't be the only Europeans there if you go. The topology of our network for Burning Man is actually very simple. We run a centralized switch, and we have a bunch of base stations distributed out across the playa, across the event site. They all get routed back to a central switch, and then from that central switch, we route calls in and out of the big outside world, mostly through voice over IP carriers. Tropo provided most of that connectivity this year. Our backhaul is provided by a group called Internet at Burning Man. This is their main tower. You can see the microwave links at the top. They run a pair of, they run some 40 megabit microwave links back to the outside world, and they also run a Ubiquiti 5 gigahertz Ubiquiti AirMax network that's used as a backbone. We had some good applications we ran this year in our network. We had something called NAT for phone numbers that would set up a temporary working caller ID for your outbound call so people could return your call if they called within a reasonable period of time. And we also had some SMS mailing list applications. They work just like regular mailing lists, but they use SMS, so they work with cheap feature phones. We first did this in 2008. Our equipment was pretty primitive. We took just basically bolted a bunch of components on a sheet of plywood and a tent. We've gotten better. By 2012, we were using much more professional packaging and much more professional equipment, which is one of the advantages of actually having a company and having revenue and money, and you can do things properly now. So this is, equipment that Range Networks brought out there. We had five units like this installed in different places with different packaging options. And, you know, we had some voice over IP phones and the Raspberry Pis in there for street cred. We're actually running a lot of stuff off of that. This is a typical installation, outdoor installation. This is at the airport. Actually, Burning Man actually has an FAA-certified airport. This was our tower site at the airport. It's a temporary mast. We have the Nano Bridge, and we have the equipment's actually mounted up on the pole to keep cable loss pretty low. So this is a largely self-contained site. This is another site at a camp called Plagon Village. They had a pre-existing 30-foot steel truss tower. They were using for an FM radio station, and we just bolted our stuff up there. This was actually one of the busiest tower sites in our installation in the whole city. This was one of the busiest sites. It's just a single Arfkin 2-watt base station. We used some trucks with pneumatic mast for some of this stuff. We ended up not liking them very much because of high cable loss. The high flex cables used on the pneumatic mast are actually high loss. But we, the trucks were available, we were using them, we weren't particularly happy with the performance we got off of them. So this is our coverage map. You can see the metric scale at the bottom. These are our five sites, and these are the coverage. The two blue circles are pole-mounted outdoor units. The two smaller red circles were trucks with pneumatic mast, and the larger red circle was our main camp, where we're running a two Arfkin system off of a 30-foot steel truss tower. So we covered most of the city except for a small hole around 7:30. Anyway, if you want more information, here are some links. If you want to get in touch with me directly through email or Twitter, there's the information. And thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it sounds like home, doesn't it?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, yep, sorry about that, yeah. Oh, wow, two Christians right next to each other. That's the first time I've noticed that. I apologize for that.
Do you want to go first?
Let's not make things complicated. You're 6 minutes and 40 seconds. If I have the right Christian, do I have the right Christian?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. You start now.
Hi, my name's Christian Kortnorst. I come from Ireland, from Hackerspace in Dublin, TOG, and we have a few thousand ducks. My talk is not about ducks, but they're kind of our mascot. It's about flames. I'm going to talk about four projects that I built with another member, and kind of what you need to do and how easy it is to do. And I'm not really going to talk about the safety much, but, you know. So we have friends in a scrapyard, so that's an ideal place to get a lot of the steel and a lot of the bits and pieces. First project, Rubin's Tube. It's a 3 meter long. The Rubin's Tube is a flaming synthesizer. So it's a large 6 inch diameter tube that has 150 holes drilled along the top. You pump gas into it and then you light it. And you get a very, very neat kind of candles along the top. You'll see photos later on. So this is, we use two bollards that they use for stopping cars driving through. We welded them together and then cut off one end. And there's a diaphragm on one end made out of a rubber handle. Sorry, a rubber glove. So we cut that and stuck it on and mashed it together a bit. So this is the results. You'll see that the sine wave that comes out of the... So there's a speaker on one end, and that then pipes music through it. And then the sine wave that comes out is trapped. The next one, we made a homemade forge, or foundry. And don't do this without cleaning it out first, obviously. It stinks to hell. You drill a hole in the top, you drill a hole in the bottom, and then we washed it out with hot water, but it's certainly smelly. Again, you can see the kind of fire extinguishers using those. That was the main part to hold the aluminium, and then we just cut off the lid or the top, and that was the lid. So you need gas. So there's a flare that we had to make. It's a bit of coke can. a bit of tube, and then a flare made out of the top. So there's a few different designs. This is the design we went with, and the coke can is just to baffle the air that goes in and out. This was the big mistake. You can see the one on the right. Don't do this. Concrete, a lot of water in concrete, metal plate, a lot of heat, trapped. Boom. The one on the left was a bit better, so we kind of learnt as we went along. Every project that I build kind of takes a day or two. You know, if it takes longer than a day or two, I don't do it, really. That's kind of the gist of it. We were able to cast aluminium. We were able to make glass go all floppy. And we used engineered bricks. That was another thing. We should have used fire bricks. And that's where another bit of explosion happened. Blacksmithing forge. I went on a blacksmithing course, again, a one-day event. Saw how easy it was. They had some homemade makeshift stuff. Bit of tube, blower, coals on top. That's what we made. And again, it was made in a few hours. And we've improved since then. So the blower is off an old oil burner. So we're making improvements as we go along. It's the first slide I haven't missed. Next one, flamethrower. So this is an ongoing project. I've built one, and the idea was, wouldn't it be funny if flames came out of fire extinguisher? And it's pretty impressive. So I'll go through. What you do is you get a fire extinguisher, take off the top, extend the top of it so that it just has kind of a nozzle coming out the top, air nipple in the bottom, pipe in your gas, and then you light the top of it, and you just put a small little pilot light at the top, and whenever you pull down the handle. The next step for this is to automate it and connect it to a drum kit. So four drums, four flaming torches, and hitting one after the other. So we're kind of expand. That's just a piece from a car cable tied. It's the what pulls up and down. So we got a slow motion camera. There's some videos on tog.ie of it, and there's some amazing shots of it. So now I have questions. Also, I have two slides just in case anybody has questions. These are other projects that I'm into. Again, kind of quick and kind of dirty. I'm not tongue out myself as a perfectionist at all, but I get things done. Can crushers, screen printing, and things like that. Any questions? Yes?
What's 100 divided by 3?
I don't know.
Please repeat the question.
What's 100 divided by 3?
No, not you, him.
What's 100 divided by 3? Anybody else want to answer that? Any good questions? Nope. I get off lightly.
If I may.
Yeah.
Do you ever use stuff like flame arresters just to make sure more explosions don't happen?
Yeah, one.
Please repeat.
Oh, sorry. Do we ever use flashback arresters? We bought a few, and they're on the likes of the Rubens tube. So a flashback arrester, it just stops the flame going back down the tube. So that's and we do we use welding gear and stuff to hold, and we do wear goggles and things like that. So the general.
You're done.
All right. Thank you very much.
Huge round of applause for all of the Lightning Talk presenters. All right, now the other Christian, if your slides decide to load, which of course they won't. Okay. Let me just get a quick second to make sure. Is this your second slide?
Yes, that's my second slide.
Okay. I will attempt to compensate. Pecha Kucha is really one of the hardest formats to do. Christian, I love the idea of the ducks. That was really awesome. Save it for next year. Matt, thank you for leading us off. And hopefully this will work. So Christian, go ahead and introduce yourself. You're 6 minutes and 40 seconds. The slides may be slightly delayed, it appears, but I know Christian will do good sub. So 6:40 starts now.
So hi, my name is Christian, and I will present some experience I had with weather balloons and small rockets. If I screw it up in English, I might change to German, where I'm more secure and safe, but all the slides are in English. So we will start with the weather balloons. It has come really mainstream. We see people launching iPhones and everything, but I did build my own. So this is a typical setup. We have the balloon filled with helium. Before it bursts, it has a diameter of about 10 meters. Now it's 2 meters. Then the parachute. The radar reflector, that's very important, because with the reflector, the ground control and the planes can see you. And then at the end, you see the payload, it's a little cube. To the size of the cube, it was they told me that it had to be a minimal size, so the half of the thing is filled with air. But there inside, you have to put all your experiments, power, telemetry. Yeah, so that's when it goes up. So it flies with about 5 meters per second towards the space. And normally the balloon bursts at about, 25, 30 kilometers, depending on the quality of the balloon. So what are the challenges that we have building a balloon like this? We have very low temperatures, very low air pressure. The weight, the maximum weight was 2.5 kilos. The tracking and telemetry, it has to be reliable, because if it doesn't work, you don't find it, like me. Someone else found it 6 months later in the woods. Yeah, the public authorities, everything has to be clear. You have to have the launch authorization, the cost, how much does it cost? At the end, the environment, what happens, for example, if my balloon falls into the sea? Does it pollute the water? Do the fish die because of the battery? I don't know. This is a picture from about 25 kilometers high. So most of people ask me, which camera did you use? I use a normal PowerShot Canon camera with a Canon hack development kit on it, so it can run scripts, so it takes a picture every 30 seconds. Most of people ask me, yeah, but does it really work in the cold? And at this height, the temperature is about 0 degrees. But first, on the sensors, you have to choose them wisely, not like me. the pressure dropped below 150 kilopascals. My sensor did stop, like the temperature did drop under 40 degrees. My sensor didn't record it, so it was very angry at me afterwards. And you really have to look what you expect and choose the sensors wisely. This is the trajectory mapped with Google Earth. It's a really cool program for that. You can view it, you can analyze it, and so to use it in Google Maps, I had to do some tricks with exporting it with Excel and in other formats. So if he eats it. And it even has cool functions like showing a graph. This is the height and the speed, the ground speed. So the maximum speed was 130 kilometers on the ground while it was falling down again. This is a cool function. I never thought would have Google Earth, but can choose it. So next, rockets. This is one of the small rockets I had built. You see the tube, the nose cone, then some electronics with a sensor, SD cards, and an Arduino for opening the parachute door. So the next question here, what are here the challenges we have when you build one? There are many, and I still haven't solved them all. So you have the high thrust. Forces with 8 or 22 Gs are applying on all the rocket. The launch vibrations, things can break. That was a problem once. The battery contact did break. the rocket did fly without any power. And other problems like RF power, security of the launch area, and at last, your own security. You don't want to build a rocket which flies into the public area. That's not really cool. So these are the cool pictures, but later we will see other pictures where I failed. Why did I fail? I'm trying to find the right building, because most of the time in the next slide you will see the parachute door breaks because of the vibrations and it falls apart. The parachute burns in the flames, and I never found this rocket again because it did fly somewhere, it dropped in the woods, and I couldn't find it. Yeah, you see it. It opens and it was burned later. So you have to really. Other common problem was not mine, but somebody did fix a PCB vertically, and during startup, some parts did break and fall down into the rocket. These are other pictures while breaking apart. The thing was, you really have to fix it. If you want to recover the rocket in good shape, you have to fix everything. On the right picture, the electronics wasn't really fixed very hard. And when it fall in the ground, everything went in the front and it crashed. And it looked like this afterwards. So that was not very cool, because if you have an SD card or something with data on it, it's really disappointing. But this was 2 years ago. Last year it did fall down, but I think it didn't break, but I didn't found it. So yeah, other problems and advice I can give you, stay in the legal zone. That's really, you can get really big problems if you launch any rockets and it hits a man or a plane or it falls on the street, I don't know. Telemetry, ham radio license is cool, but you can't do it, without. People are doing it with iPhones and telemetry over SMS. Safety first, even. And the last point, organize yourself. This is the thing at the launch areas. We write all the cases and scenarios that could happen when this falls apart, when this light open. Really prepare yourself for every occasion, so you don't have to think on the spot. These are some other cool projects. How you can contact me, I think the easiest thing is you can find me in the launch area on the fourth floor or somewhere in the talks, I don't know. Thank you very much, and if you have any questions, you can ask me.
Just to, so we are currently, okay, so we are, it looks like we're 2 minutes behind. Tomas, are you in the room? Tomas, you're good? Are you right? Okay, good, so you're up on deck. And the internet paradox. I can't get rid of that loading thing, but are you good?
Okay.
Okay, it should disappear. Your 6:40 starts now.
Okay, my name is Michiel Lenaars. I work for a charity called NLS Foundation. We fund lots of internet technologies. We go back to the 80s where we were the organization that introduced TCP/IP in Europe. And we kind of fund all the way in the stack, all the way from the root servers of the internet all the way up to browser plugins. You see a number of projects that we funded here, from Tor Hidden Services to GNUnet, OpenBTS, Unhosted NoScript, Anonymous Server. This is all stuff probably you know, just to know where we come from, because we found out there's a common problem attached to all of these, and we only found out after 15 years of funding everywhere down the stack. And the problem is that everybody thinks of the internet as a great and innovative place. And I mean, we see all these new things added every day. And the problem is that is, in a way it's true, but in a way it's not true. Because if you look down another layer, the core services of the internet haven't changed for 20 years. Basically, we get our PHP, our MySQL, our 10 email addresses. If we get if we go to an ISP, we have to upload our files with FTP. And the only thing that happens is that we get services that are added by external third parties that we can use. And those are innovative. But the internet itself is basically stuck in base one. Look at all these things. And why are they not happening? It is because, basically, they're too difficult for people to add. And the problem is that the internet is scaled in a very weird way. We have 2 billion people on it. We have 240 million domain names. And it's just that nothing has ever made it that wide because we depend on a manual labor to do it. So not a single technology that you saw on the list has actually made it internet-wide in the last 20 years. And that's because there's a big gaping hole between us, the avant-garde that does all the cool kids stuff, and the real world. Just as a thought experiment, could we introduce email today? If we invented email today, even we know it's a working model, but we could introduce Gmail. That we could, but we couldn't introduce email. So the model is broken. The model where we have a couple of companies that provide us with these services. And what is causing this? Well, we think it's the hosting companies. There's a price war going on there. I mean, I saw here in Germany, there's 64 cents a month, 0 cents a month. There's a price war, and nobody's investing. Everybody's just running their PHP 5 with their front page extensions. And I mean, these are the contemporaries, the Tamagotchi and the Netscape. We lost them all. So if you multiply, I mean, that seems like a non-significant problem. But if you multiply it by 2 billion internet users and 200 million domain names, all of a sudden the internet stops. It doesn't do anything. It's the first million domain names move. Yeah, right. But the big volume does it. So there's this hosting. The cheap hosting is a major bottleneck for everything that we want, because IPv6, we know it's necessary. Asian people can't get on the internet because there's no more numbers. There's only 4.5 billion. They're sparsely given, so they can't get on it decently. But we're hogging the innovation because we don't need it. The hosting providers don't need it. So just as an analogy, I mean, this is the firmware that's built into the common internet. And the problem is, we shouldn't expect people to tamper with firmware. We shouldn't expect people to go into the DNS and then fix stuff for themselves. All of us can do it. The problem is, the big volume doesn't do it. And that's hurting us. That's hurting us tremendously, because as soon as we, as the digerati or the people that know don't fix it for others than ourselves, we end up with a lot of shit. And that shit has a couple of names: Twitter, Facebook, Skype. I mean, those are pseudo systems, pseudo infrastructure, where you're basically you get an identity from them. Look at a company like Microsoft. They give you Skype, they give you Hotmail, they give you Outlook.com, and in every of those services, you have a different identity. We have 2 billion people trying to fit into this cramped space, and your identity is fragmented all over the place. And that basically, it sucks deep and it's not necessary because we all have proper identification. We have 240 million domain names. We own the internet. We have identities there that work. So instead of having all these unlinked identities, why don't we use our domain names to do it? And we're actually paying these hosting companies for hosting. 140 character publishing isn't that difficult. So why can't I follow people on their email address? Why can't I send them like a 100 megabyte file on their email address? Why don't we have the protocols up already? We know the protocols. And the same goes for federated social web and all these things. We know how it works. We have the code. It's there. It's just nobody has ever bothered to package it together and to give it to ISP, say, good, this will fit in your 10 gigabytes a month. This doesn't cost any processing. It's dirt cheap. So why don't we fix it? There's a huge potential because even with the two things that are working, web and email, there's a lot wrong. I mean, people get spam, and it's because we haven't used SPF and DKIM, which are two technologies to basically prevent spam from at least Joe-jobbing from occurring. So we have to fix certain things. We have to add new stuff. The new stuff is, this whole list, I'm not going to even bother reading it, but there's just such a shitload of things that hundreds of millions of users are using, that we have open alternative source, standards-based, it's been mature, developed, 100 million users, and still we're not getting it because the hosting companies are doing it. So what is the vision that we have is basically that the user controls its own identity and that we can retrieve it from in a way backwards. So I don't have to go to Facebook and ask, do you know a user named Michi Lenaerts? No, you can actually go to an identity that you know of me, private, personal, or business identity, and then see what services I'm using. Just turn it around. So this is our basic master plan, which ends in restoring world order. For those that don't get this in 20 seconds, I have a neat version which I'll put out on a brochure on the outside. But it's basically all the components are there. So why don't we bloody well do this? And that's about it. Well, that's 6 minutes and 40 seconds. So if you have any questions, come and talk to me or go to that website. We just put it up today. So it's a premiere. So bear with us if we're like writing stupid things, and correct us instead of burning us down, because we think we're onto something here. That's it.
Okay, just a couple of quick reminders. All of you guys that are stuck back there by the door, we always have plenty of open spaces here, as that bottle reminded me. As you're leaving, please pick up a piece of trash to take with you, especially a bottle on the floor so it doesn't resonate. We're in the middle of the Pecha Kucha section of the talks. It's 20 slides, 20 seconds per slide. I believe we are... Okay, we are now 3 minutes behind, so without any further ado, Pecha Kucha, go.
Okay, hi, my name is Tomasz, and I'm working as a security engineer. I will tell you about the DNS invalid packets, so packets that are from one point invalid and one point invalid. I guess it is not a new topic, so in Poland we call it a reheated pork. So. First, what is a DNS name? DNS name is a set of DNS labels separated with dots. Everybody know that. We can use any amount of names, and this is defined by RFC, of course. What is a DNS label? DNS label can consist any kind of characters from this set. So we have A from A to Z, from 0 to 9, and this is case insensitive, and we can also have a dash inside. And then it is also defined in the RFC, so this is not new for everyone. So what we have inside DNS answer packet? So we have a resource record, and each resource record contains name from the query, type, class, TTL, and R data. And I was wondering what we can put inside our data. Do the RFC define our data? And RFC defines our data is a variable length string of octets, so you can just put there anything. And the format varies according to the type and class. So if we have a, for example, if we have a type A, we have an IP address. A, 4A means we will have a IPv6, and if we have a Peter record, we will have a DNS name in the air data. And how does the air data looks like if we have the DNS name inside the air data? So we have the number of bytes, and this pattern repeats. And at the end, we have the zero. At the parsing section, the number of bytes are replaced with dots, and we have the full DNS name revealed from the resource record. And the important thing is that bytes should be a valid DNS label. So we expect that in this place we should have the from A to Z and 0, 9, nothing else. So my question was, what happened if we put anything in those bytes? So I start a project called Ugly. I don't know if you spell it in English. Ugly responder. So I will be able to put anything in those bytes because normal DNS servers forbid to do that. So the first version of my software. This is the piece of the configuration file. I was able to almost put anything. So binary data. Any character, any amount of dots, and et cetera, so how does it look in the real life? If you are using a Linux and using a glibc, for example, to get the reverse name of the IP address, you are safe because the glibc is validating the name and you will not get any trash. But what happened if you are using Windows? So if you are, for example, run at sysinternal TCP view, you will get a lot of trash inside the remote address if you enable the resolve IP to DNS name. And yeah, from the first feeling, everything you can do is just get a fancy text. So I can put the here low, no reverse DNS. Nothing special, but in the second look, we can, for example, put a space. 3, 2, 1. Yeah, we have the spaces here. So again, nothing special, but the output of the netstat look a little malformed. But you all can see that I also put a line break here. So if someone is logging the netstat output into the file, you will probably get something terrible in your output file, and you will not be able to parse it using any of your scripts normally. And the question is, what we can do more with this? So there was a Polish movie called Hacker, and they were just hacking send mail using Emacs. So this is just a local joke. And I was wondering, okay, where can I put my DNS answers and expect any interesting results? So I found, I came with an idea, okay, let's maybe do a XSS using a DNS. So DNS is really, really at the bottom of the network, and XSS is in the browser in the user end. Is it possible? Yes, of course. We just need to find a good place to do it. So I found one very, very popular. You have network tools, and if you do the DNS query of your IP address and your PTR record contains some invalid data, you will get XSS. So I place a line and line break here and get this executed by my browser. So the question is, what we can do more with this? And this probably opens a lot of new vectors of attacks. For example, if you think about very complex administrative back front ends that are displayed using HTML and using I don't know, a lot of DNS information to show to the user, for example, to show what is the country from For the IP address, so we have the network UI. We can do a log malformation. For example, we can try to do a SQL injection. And if you have any experience in this matter or want to talk about it, you can contact me using email, or I'll be outside the doors just at the end of the presentation. So thank you.
All right, it looks like we are still 3 minutes behind, but doing pretty all right. Everything good?
Yep.
All right, go for it.
So I'm Noah Rubinstein. I'm going to talk to you about a telephony project, a hardware telephony project I have been doing with our team for the last 3 years. We're building an open source IPBX, all-in-one IPBX for small office and home office. And these are the prototypes. And well, this is the real deal. So I'm going to talk about a little bit of history, what we're doing for doing something completely open source on the software and hardware side, and how it works, what's in the box, and the status. So a little bit of history. Maybe if you're old enough, you remember that I was not born yet. It's an old Metra IPBX, an old Metra PABX, so it's all analog telephony. It's really big. And nowadays, we don't use this stuff anymore. Now we have IP and internet, and it's really fun. So we're using other protocols, but the transition is not completely finished. And even though some telcos try to stop doing ISDN and all this stuff because it's a bother, it's still the cheapest way to get a reliable connection for a company. So the normal solution for a small company buying an IPBX is they will a free software based IPBX is they will buy a PC and very, very expensive telephony cards, and it will be like very expensive. And we're trying to change that by building an all-in-one solution that will enable a small company or a home office or hackerspace to answer all their telephony needs with just one simple and open hardware solution. So it's open hardware. One important thing is that we attach importance to the ethics of producing electronics, and we think that it's not possible to produce ethically produce electronics if we don't know where it comes from. So we're producing locally, and as I'm French, we're pure producing in France. I don't know if you've ever heard about OHND. It's a label for open hardware. The principle is that we're kind of taking a sticker on the thing and saying it's open hardware, and you can find the source here. And the sources are GPLv3, because my company loves GPLv3. One time I was asking a salesperson of my company, why are you always saying GPLv3, and he said, I didn't know, they just told me to do that. So it's GPLv3. Okay, and the only non-free thing inside is a firmware blob running on our system on chip. Because, well, the chips are not free, and that's pretty much what we call them get to be free. But all the rest is free. You can get the source on 0001001.ogi.ohende.org. That's kind of the point of Ohende. Let's take a look at how it works. If the slide changes. Yeah, so this is kind of what's inside. And this is the real deal. So it's kind of like a PC. It's based on an x86 architecture. It's a SoC produced by Intel that I think we're very few in the world to use. And I'm already on the software architecture. So the goal is using a simple asterisk-based solution. My company is producing an asterisk-based solution, so that's what we're using on our server. And on the kernel space side, well, we developed some drivers that use some Intel code and some non-Intel code for working on all the chips. And on the firmware side, on the boot firmware side, I mean the BIOS, we used a free software project called Core Boot to replace the, you know, the standard stack that you will use on your standard PC to boot up your PC that has a lot of non-free software. And that at the time where I did this drawing, it was before everybody was talking about the EFI bootlock stuff. So no, this is an example, and we're replacing the EFI stuff with Core Boot. And I guess there are some people from the Core Boot community here because they are basically German. and so we did some support for Core Boot. It works very well. And we have arrived at a working hardware. This is a working prototype. We have already some prototypes running, and we're trying to get more prototypes going to hackerspace and school and stuff. And we have a production for the real deal on the way. The project is not completely terminated, completely finished on the software and firmware side. We have a lot of unclean code that we still have to send upstream, but it's going well. And well, we need some get some software for flashing. So this is the status of the project, is that it's technically working. It's not finished, but it's technically working. And we're not sure about what development effort is going to be put in the project in the future. So if you want to help, please talk to me. You can contact me, my mail address. And yeah, please come and see me. Thank you very much.
All right, as a reminder for those of you joining us, we are in the lightning talks. We're going to go without a break straight through till 1500, and then up next, if you, another quick reminder, if you need information on what is happening or contact information or links from any of the presentations, they are available on the wiki at events.ccc.de. There's a link to the wiki at that page, and from there, there's a link to the Lightning Talks. We are in day three, and we are about to enter the regular Lightning Talk round, 2 minutes behind schedule. But Rami, are you ready to go?
Yep.
Okay, excellent. So now we are back into the five-minute Lightning Talk round, where slides do not advance automatically, and you must ask for a slide if you want it to proceed. Also, when we reach time, we're going to very silently ramp up from 10 into the buzzer sound. We'll practice that very, very quickly. So,
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay, excellent. And without any further ado, oh wait, is that? Please tell me I got that right.
Yep.
Good.
It's
okay.
Only one slide.
Yep. Go.
I'm gonna do my very quick talk in German because it's about German public libraries, and I think it's not very interesting to talk about it in English because the project is currently completely in German. Es geht in dem Projekt, also ich lese gerne und ich lese noch ziemlich gerne auf Papier und noch nicht auf E-Books. Und weil ich mir nicht so viel Bücher leisten kann, wie ich gerne lese, benutze ich die Stadtbücherei. Und die Stadtbüchereien, die haben alle seit ziemlich vielen Jahren ziemlich coole Dinge. Da kann man nämlich mittlerweile online den Bestand durchsuchen und dann auch, das wisst ihr wahrscheinlich alle, und in den meisten Städten kann man auch nachgucken, was man denn eigentlich so für Medien ausgeliehen hat und vor allem, wann man die zurückgeben muss. Das Problem ist, wenn ich am Computer sitze, ist das selten der Fall, dass mich das interessiert. Die Situationen, in denen mich das interessiert, ist, wenn ich in der Buchhandlung stehe und mich frage, muss ich dieses Buch überhaupt kaufen oder kann ich das eigentlich auch in der Bücherei ausleihen? Wenn mir jemand hier ein Buch empfiehlt oder wenn ich abends im Bett liege und mir denke, Mist, muss ich dieses Buch eigentlich morgen zurückgeben? Und was ich dann habe, ist mein Smartphone. Und diese Software, die diese Büchereien da verwenden, die sind größtenteils älter als ich und das sind hässliche Framesets, die auf einem Touchscreen nicht zu bedienen sind, wirklich nicht zu bedienen. Und deswegen habe ich mich irgendwann hingesetzt vor Wut und habe eine Android-App dafür angefangen, die diese quasi diese Websoftware bedient, Touchscreen-freundlich. Und warum ich da einen Lightning-Talk drüber halte, wie gesagt, es gibt unterschiedlichste Software dafür, die Bibliotheken, da gibt es ungefähr 11 Hersteller in Deutschland, Österreich und der Schweiz und die sind alle gleich scheiße, diese Software, aber der Punkt ist jetzt eben, dass dieser Bereich, wo ich sehen kann, wo ich Bücher vorbestellen kann, wo ich sehen kann, wann muss ich meine Bücher angeben, der sieht überall anders raus und ich komme aus Mannheim und ich komme natürlich nur in den Mannheimer rein, weil ich nur in Mannheim einen Büchereiausweis habe. Das heißt, ich brauche für alle anderen Städte, selbst die Städte, die die gleiche Software verwenden, haben teilweise noch so kleine Unterschiede, dass ich das nicht programmieren kann. Das heißt, ich brauche aus jeder Stadt jemanden, der dieses Projekt cool findet und der mir 5 Minuten opfert und mir eine E-Mail schreibt, aus welcher Stadt er kommt. Ihr könnt unter der Adresse nachgucken, welche Städte ich schon habe, welche ich noch brauche. Und der mir 5 Minuten opfert, mir eine E-Mail schreibt, sagt, aus welcher Stadt er kommt und ich schreibe euch, wie ihr mir ganz schnell helfen könnt. Das ist eine kleine Sache, in jeder Stadt ein bisschen unterschiedlich, deswegen kann ich es nicht einfach so als Tutorial dahin schreiben. Aber es wäre super cool, wenn sich Leute melden. Ich bin auch noch den Rest des Kongresses hier und ihr könnt mich zu dem Projekt befragen oder direkt auf mich zukommen und mir eure Hilfe anbieten. Ist auch alles Open Source und auf GitHub, das heißt, wenn jemand mitprogrammieren möchte, freue ich mich auch.
All right, and as we are running a little bit short of time, if we get the next talk off, we will get back on the time. We are not taking any questions. There's still plenty of seats all across here. We're in the 5-minute lightning talk round. Georg, are you ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Let's do this. 5 minutes starts now.
Okay, so my name is Georg, and I would like to present you a nice trick with policy routing. Slide. So this trick we are going to discuss now is automatically routing HTTP requests for some specific websites through a VPN connection. So we are going to consider the following network layout. We have a nice little local area network with a Linux router. The Linux router manages the internet connection and the Linux router also has a VPN connection to a VPN server in the USA. Slide. So our goal is that if some client on the network starts an HTTP request for a website, the Linux router by itself decides which connection it should use. So should it use the standard internet connection or should it use the VPN connection to the USA so that it are not presented with some sort of message like, okay, this video is not available in your country. And this should all be done without requiring any specific configuration on the client side. So you just connect your laptop to the network, you open your browser, type in the address of, for example, mystream.com and so, and the Linux router will automatically reroute the HTTP request through the VPN connection. And this all can be done pretty easily, as it turns out, so easily that I can explain it in hopefully a few minutes. So the basic idea is that we set up a transparent proxy server. The proxy server catches all the requests. It will tag the requests for the specific streaming sites. And we use this tagging information later on to route the request through the VPN connection. Slide. So the concrete implementation looks approximately like this. So for each streaming site, we add 4 configuration options to the proxy server configuration. In this case, this is Squid, but it could probably also be done with another proxy server. The first access control list creates an access control list which will match all requests for a subdomain of mystream.com. The second access control list will match any descendant or child requests. So for example, if you get an HTML file from mystream.com and it will contain image tag for an image from some other domain.org, then it will have a referrer which contains the string mystream.com, though the second access control list will match. And the two configuration options at the bottom essentially say, okay, if any of the two access controllers on the top match, then use the IP address of the VPN connection as an outgoing address, also as a source address to get the data slide. So in this way, we have now tagged all the requests in the sense that all data will be fetched using the IP of the VPN connection. Now we just have to take care of the routing, because currently still the request would be routed with the default route, so they will just use the default internet connection. We do this routing by creating a new routing table, which in this case will be named USA VPN. This is the first command. Then we add a new routing rule which says, okay, every packet which has an origin address of the VPN IP of the Linux router will be routed using the routing table USA VPN. This is the second command. And the last command is that we add actually a route to this newly created routing table USA VPN. And this route essentially says, okay, forward everything to the VPN server, and it should take care of it. And that's everything that we have to do. So now if a request gets in, one, for example, mystream.com, one of the access control list will match, then the corresponding outgoing address will be set, and it will be routed to the VPN server. And the VPN server will route the packet using its default route. So it will seem like you have used the VPN connection to access mystream.com. And that's everything that you have to do, actually. Slide.
1 minute.
Okay, there's another thing that you also can do with this technique is that you can combine two internet connections to create a better one. So, for example, if you have a satellite connection and an LTE connection, you want to split the HTTP request for small files and for large files, so that large files go through the satellite connection, which has unlimited traffic, and small files should go to the LTE connection, which has a limited amount of traffic but also a shorter latency. So, essentially, instead of matching domain names, you're then going to match for file types so that you get the HTML file a lot faster, then you can already read a page, and the pictures will get later on. You will get the pictures later on, because it's not so important that the pictures are loaded immediately. Yeah, and I think I won't spare the configuration options. That should be enough. Thanks.
Okay. Did not want to get buzzed. But I guess my timer can buzz me. Okay, good to go. 5 minutes starts now. And are we? Crap. For 1 minute behind, it's my fault, as usual. Okay. Again, all information is available on the wiki for the lightning talks for today and tomorrow. Unfortunately, we are entirely booked, and we're running through what is going to be probably the longest session of lightning talks ever held at a Congress. We've been going since 12:45 without a break. Everybody has shown up. Everybody's been on time. And I will try to make us not 2 minutes behind, so your 5 minutes starts now.
Okay, hi. So I'm not Anatol. I'm Sasha. Anatol couldn't come, so I'm doing this talk. Next slide, please. So probably some people here in this room use SSH, and some people will probably use a key to public keys logins to a lot of servers, and they probably manage a bunch of servers and have their public key all around across servers. Some of them they might not even know about anymore because it's so long ago. And this is totally unmanaged in most situations. Keys don't have an expiration date. So what will you do if someone has your private key? You basically have to go through all servers where you have your public key on to revoke your key manually. This is quite shitty. So we thought we need a solution for that. Next slide, please. Okay, so next slide, please. I think I told this already. So, So the OpenSSH project has some solutions for this, and they want to have it in OpenSSH 8.0, but we don't think this is a solution already, because you will probably have other versions of SSH around for quite a long time on some of your servers, and you want something that's really compatible with that too. Next slide, please. We realized that there's a command option in authorized keys. So you can actually invoke a command from authorized keys to do stuff. And that has been in OpenSSH and in Dropbear for quite a long time. So this is something we can use. Next slide. We also realized that OpenSSL can take in SSH keys, so you can actually sign content with your private key. Next slide. And with that tools we could create Shark. And Shark is about the authorization and revocation of SSH keys. Next slide. Shark at this point comprises of two programs, the Shark Gen program, that's basically a wrapper on OpenSSL and creates nice DNS records that you can put in DNS. You can look them up by fingerprint, and then you can see whether or not the key that you're trying to use is still valid and for how long it is valid or that it has been revoked. So now we have a central place in which we can actually revoke the key. Next slide, please. And we have the Shark program that's actually used is used in the authorized key file to actually do this checking, to actually connect to a DNS server and to get a response and act upon it. It does this by you give it the fingerprint, and it actually uses the command in which you just provide a valid email address, and from that it derives your domain in which the DNS resides. You could also use an option to directly state on which server the Shark program has to look up the DNS record. Next slide, please. So this is how the...
1 minute.
Yeah. this is how it's more or less used. You generate this key and you put it in the DNS. Next slide. So you invoke it and use it. So next slide. And this is the output. You don't get the fancy colors, but the idea is quite simple. We also give output if you're logging in that states when your key will be expiring, because otherwise you will
30 seconds.
Probably lock yourself out because you don't remember that your key is about to expire. Okay, next slide. We want to extend this. It currently runs with RSA only, so we want to extend it to DSA and, of course, elliptical curve DSA. Okay, next slide.
Good afternoon. My name is Sebastian, as you cannot see on this slide. I want to introduce you to a concept which was originally born last year on the UN conference on LICAS. They experimented with personal hosting, letting normal people host physical files, actually, but giving people a sense of hosting, and this is where this comes from. These days, you've got, as you can see here, loads of wireless devices, and then one of them is actually not a wireless device, as you can see, the Raspberry Pi. And these wireless devices, mainly the top one, uh, the Well, the blue one, the TP-Link ones, they're the most interesting in my eyes because you get full root, you get Linux on them, and they don't use any power and come with batteries. So the idea of the concept is to get an access point running Linux and storage, which you can carry in your bag. And when you carry it in your bag, it will search other nodes, and it will look for nodes, and when it finds a node, it'll talk to it and say, hi, what do you have on data? And so, oh, I'm interested in data, and it'll share. And when it has downloaded the data, at the end of the day, you can look like you're looking at Facebook. You can look what it has downloaded. It can find status messages, or it can find files, music, whatever you describe to be interested in. And basically, the idea, the concept being described here then is taking the internet offline. You've got offline mesh communication, low latency, completely hosted by the owner of the files without intermediate infrastructure owned by telecom organizations or very smart hackers who people don't know. So that's basically the concept of this talk. So hopefully you can think about it, think what you want about it, but this is the concept. If you have any questions, I think I have time.
Okay, you have 2 minutes, 55 seconds on the clock, but we'll do 1 minute of questions since you finished in 2 minutes. 1 minute. And please repeat the speaker's score. Please repeat the question.
Okay.
Any questions?
No questions. All right. Short talk.
Where can they find you later?
They can find me online either at Sebastian Webmind or number 6664.
Okay, awesome. Thank you very much.
Ciao.
And so the time is now 14:20, and maybe we will actually get back on time from up to a 5 minute deficit. Hogg, ready to go?
Yeah.
5 minutes starts now.
Okay. Der Talk ist auf Deutsch. Ich möchte euch Freies Magazin vorstellen. Next slide. Freies Magazin ist ein monatlich erscheinendes Online-Magazin über alle Themen related zu freier Software, Open Source, Linux, sehr breit. Das Format der Artikel reicht von sehr klein, einseitig monatlicher Kernelrückblick oder eine Rezension von dem Buch über mehrseitig oder sogar ein Perl-Tutorium, das über mehrere Monate sich erstreckt. Die Lizenz des Magazins ist so frei, wie es nur sein kann. Die Ausgabe, ihr kriegt das Magazin entweder als HTML, EPUB oder PDF. Ich mag es sehr, weil es sehr angenehm zu lesen ist. Ich habe am Ende ein Beispiel, wie es aussieht. Next slide. Hier kurz als Wortwolke die Themen des letzten Jahres oder dieses Jahres. Ich bin der Meinung, da ist für jeden etwas dabei, also schaut es euch mal an. Next slide. Wo findet ihr das Ganze? Website www.freiesmagazin.de. Wenn ihr Fragen habt, es gibt ein Kontaktformular, es gibt eine E-Mail-Adresse, Feedback ist immer gern gesehen. Es gibt auch eine Leserbriefsektion wie in einem guten Magazin. Intern benutzen wir zur Kommunikation DokuWiki, wo wir uns absprechen, wer macht was, welcher Abschnitt, welcher Artikel. Wir planen und tauschen uns aus. Wir benutzen ein Subversion Repository für alle Artikel zu revisionieren, aber auch um dort Richtlinien für die Setzer-Layouter abzulegen. Die gesamte Verwaltung ist da drin, Skripte, die benutzt werden, um die Artikel eben zu setzen. Wenn ich sage wir, das Projekt, ich bin nur ein sehr kleines Rad in der Wack. Wir haben etwa ein bisschen mehr als ein Dutzend, vielleicht 20 Mitarbeiter, nochmal so viele freie Autoren. Das bringt mich auch zur nächsten Slide. Next slide. Ich möchte euch anregen, mitzumachen. Freies Magazin ist eine sehr schöne Möglichkeit, auch für Nicht-Programmierer etwas an die Community zurückzugeben. Ja? Man kann entweder als freier Autor oder als Übersetzer Artikel eben einreichen. Wenn man ein tolles Programm benutzt, Open Software benutzt, findet das toll, schreibt man einfach einen Artikel darüber und veröffentlicht ihn. Die Redaktion, es gibt Autorenrichtlinien und die Redaktion hilft einem, wie das funktioniert. Oder man arbeitet als Setzer, Layouter oder in der Redaktion mit. Möglichkeiten gibt es viele. Geht auf die Seite freiesmagazin.de, mitmachen oder schreibt eine E-Mail, kontaktiert mich, ich bin noch bis morgen hier. Next slide. Wenn es Fragen gibt, wie gesagt, an mich. Next slide. Can you scroll through, Nick? So, yeah, just slowly go through. Das ist eine, die PDF-Ausgabe, just go on. Und einfach nur als Beispiel, das ist die letzte Ausgabe des Jahres, wie das aussieht. Ihr seht ein sehr ansprechendes Design. Wir legen Wert darauf, dass das auch konsistent durchgezogen wird. Nette Screenshots, nette Bilder. Es gibt immer auch eine Linkliste am Ende des Artikels. Es gibt am Ende des Jahres eine Liste von allen Artikeln, die im Jahr erschienen sind. Das heißt, wenn ihr euch jetzt nicht sicher seid, ob Themen dabei sind, die euch interessieren, ladet euch die aktuelle Ausgabe runter. Ganz am Ende ist, wie gesagt, ein Index aller Artikel dieses Jahres. Vielen Dank. Fragen?
And with that extra 45 seconds, I'm going to accept a cookie delivery. Huge round of applause for cookies, which are mine, not yours.
Don't ever again steal cookies from this nice Mr. Nick Farr.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the cookie delivery. Huge round of applause for having the courage to get up on stage and bring me something which I hope will sustain me for the next, we have next, oh, next probably half hour, 45 minutes, but without any further ado, you ready?
Yes.
5 minutes starts now.
Hallo, ich bin Sofakissen und ich wollte das Projekt Hardware für alle vorstellen. Das entstand vor ein, zwei Monaten aus der Idee, dass irgendwie jeder einen Computer haben sollte, aber öfters kommt das ja mal vor, man liest das vielleicht auf Twitter, dass ein Rechner von jemandem kaputt geht und er sich nicht sofort einen neuen leisten kann. Da gab es dann zum Beispiel diese Spendenaktion für Stefan Urbach, wo ihm ein neuer Rechner gespendet wurde. Da gab es Anfang des Jahres schon mal eine für einen anderen Twitterer und da kam mir so die Idee, wie kann man das irgendwie for the rest of us machen. Für Menschen, die nicht irgendwie so ein bisschen bekannt sind, die so großen Support irgendwie mobilisieren können. Da kam irgendwie auch die Idee, keiner hat ja sein erstes Smartphone oder sein erstes Notebook irgendwie rumstehen. Und diese alten Geräte sind ja nicht schlechter dadurch, dass sie einfach nicht mehr benutzt werden, weil man das Nachfolgemodell hat. Und diese Geräte könnte man ja einfach jemandem geben, der sich keins leisten kann, wenn man sie selbst nicht mehr benutzt. Und da wollten wir eine Plattform bauen, wo man sehr leicht diese Menschen irgendwie zusammenbringen kann. Wenn jemand hat ein Gerät über ein Smartphone oder ein Notebook oder einen anderen funktionierenden Computer, kann er einfach jemandem den schenken, tatsächlich. Und da haben wir diese Plattform gebaut, die gibt es jetzt seit heute auch unter hardware-für-alle.de. Man kann auch einfach bei Google Hardware für alle eingeben, dann findet man das. Das ist so ein bisschen unsere Public Beta jetzt. Da kann man sich einfach einloggen über seinen Twitter, Facebook, Google oder GitHub-Account, kann ein Gerät eintragen über ein Formular ganz einfach und dann kann jemand, der gerade wirklich irgendwie dringenden Bedarf an einem Gerät hat, sich keins leisten kann aus seiner Situation heraus, denjenigen anschreiben und dann können die dieses Verschenken der Hardware quasi unter sich organisieren. Die Idee dahinter ist halt so ein sehr idealistischer Solidaritätsgedanke und auch der Gedanke, dass irgendwie Internet eine Grundversorgung sein sollte. Und der Zugang zum Internet ist halt nicht nur der Internetanschluss, sondern auch das Gerät, mit dem man irgendwie den Zugang zum Internet wirklich dann hat. Und das ist halt ein Kostenfaktor, der oft irgendwie nicht bedacht wird. Und nicht jeder kann sich halt einen Computer immer leisten in der Situation, wo er einen braucht, wenn dann halt der bestehende Computer kaputt geht. Und Ja, ich würde euch jetzt einfach mal aufrufen, auch diese Seite dann quasi zu testen, die jetzt online ist, wenn ihr irgendwie, ich weiß nicht, vielleicht haben viele auch einfach noch ein altes Notebook irgendwie zu Hause rumstehen, das sie nicht mehr brauchen und dass sie, ja, verschenken ist halt im Zweifelsfall immer besser als wegwerfen oder verrotten lassen von so alten Geräten, die ja immer noch gut sind. Also geht einfach auf die Seite irgendwie, loggt euch mal ein, schaut euch das an, testet das ein bisschen, wenn ihr irgendwelche Fragen habt noch dazu, da euch irgendwas auffällt oder sonst was, könnt ihr mich auch ansprechen oder den Virus, der das programmiert hat. Wir sind in der zweiten Etage gegenüber vom Bällebad, könnt ihr uns ansprechen. Ja, das war's soweit.
Cookies. I love cookies. Thank you for that. And thank you for that awesome quick presentation. Not a word of it I understood. All right, we are going to take a very, very slight break. We're actually on time. And someone, for the first time in the Lightning Talks, actually submitted a video, which is something you can actually do. So we're going to go ahead and I think we're going to advance this a little bit so only play 4 minutes of it to allow for 1 minute of talk. Is that good? It's okay? Okay, great. So that's what we're going to do. Oh, if you wanted to talk over it, we can mute it for you. Would you prefer that?
Yeah, let's mute.
Okay, that's okay. That's easy peasy. Okay,
sorry.
No problem. Go for it.
Okay, I want to talk about Positive Hack Days. It's a Russian security conference. We have second edition last year. Our conference was born because, you know, there are very unusual situation with Russian security community. From one side, there are no Russian security community. From second side, there are a lot of dirty hackers from Russia. So we trying to combine, to change with mind, to create Russian security community, to invite different people all around the world to demonstrate talent, to help talented people to prove their skill, and we start to organize Positive Hack Days. Now Positive Hack Days is 2 days in international hacking forum with 6 tracks of conference with CTF. Unfortunately, CTF course already finished, but I think you can participate in online hack quest during Positive Hack Days and our new challenges. Different challenges, for example, air drone hacking contest, ATM workshop, and snatch online banking competition. We will be held the snatch online hacking, online banking hacking competition in hall 30 since 3 p.m. So join us. And our idea is to combine different kind of people, business community, hacking community, and security guys, security experts from different vendors on one place, and to make them interact with each other. To when young guys hacking online bank or ATM machine, and somebody from bank come to them and ask it, how you did it? So it's very useful from our point of view, and this is our approach. Different people from different industries, from different idea in one place with and we can communicate. And of course, we have open bar if any interest in it. With our star, this is a Russian-style CTF, to drunk to hack challenge. So if IPS detect you, you must take a shot. With winners of to drunk to hack. I think PhDs 2012 was awesome, and we will do our best to make it better in 2000. In next year, PhD is free, and I hope you will join us if you have something to submit, workshop, papers, or hands-on lab, we are waiting for you, and I hope you, if you don't want to submit, you can just visit Moscow and join our forum and have a lot of fun and get a lot of knowledge. So that's also rock and roll. Thank you.
All right, most excellent. Thank you. Sergey from the Positive Hack Days crew. Oliver, are you ready to go?
Yep.
And oh my goodness, we are actually, believe it or not, we're actually 2 minutes ahead of schedule. So don't fail. Go.
Okay. In contrast with our intellect, computers double the performance every 18 months, so the danger is real that they could develop intelligence and eventually take over the world. This sounds like taken from the next best fantasy sci-fi novel, but it's not. It's taken from a quite famous person around here, and I guess a few people at least know his name. Next slide, please. Stephen Hawking. This is the topic I want to talk about. Next slide, please. It's the technological singularity, as it is called. And each company and institute that has something to do with that is the Singularity Institute. And it does a little bit of research in the topic of friendly and unfriendly artificial intelligence. And before I want to talk about that, I want to talk a bit about myself. Next slide, please. I am a student of mathematics at Stuttgart University. I'm teaching a high school course for decision theory and Bayesian reasoning. And I'm working together at this moment with the Singularity Institute to create a safe AI science. And why we need a safe AI science, I will develop in the next few slides. Next slide, please. So, the biggest problem with AI security and so on is the problem that normally AI, at least if we build in self-optimizing AI, it normally ends in a feedback loop. That means, normally, if we are able to develop an AI with at least roughly near or anything at all human intelligence, then it should be able to optimize its codes further because it had far more easy access to its own source code. This optimized AI, because it is more intelligent, we needed intelligence to build an AI, should be able to build or optimize itself to an even better AI. This should obviously lead to an intelligent feedback loop and lead to skyrocketing in the intelligence of the AI. But there's one little problem. Next slide, please. Everyone is agreed that this kind of feedback loop can exist, that this happens, that in the artificial intelligence science, this is well known. But there's one strange thing. If you do this further and develop this anything beyond the human intelligence level, then normally an angry mob turns out of nowhere, stones you to death, or something like that. Because at this moment, the artificial intelligence community does not want to think or does not want to talk about anything that is higher than human intelligence. And that is a huge problem, because obviously this feedback loop has no reason to stop at human level intelligence. And obviously there are implications that we have to think about from higher than human level intelligence. And next slide, please. That is kind of the reason why we should do that. Eliza Yudkowsky, a research fellow of mine, said, this isn't quite fittingly, the AI does not hate you, nor does it love you, but you are made out of atoms it can use for something else. Normally you give an AI a task, a thing it has to optimize, a thing it has to do, and there's no reason why it should care at all for human life, the things we value, the things we love and do about. And AI and safe AI science is a thing we have to talk about, but we are not doing it this at all at the moment in the artificial intelligence community. So next slide, please. The Singularity Institute is an institute that tries to fix it, that tries to make research, talk with the community, talk with paper, talk with newspaper, talk with overall the media, and tries to get more awareness to this whole topic. And it needs your help. It needs money, it needs contributions, it needs people who can help. And we really need more hackers, especially because at this moment we are lacking in, we need more mathematicians, we need more programmers to do this whole from a more basic science level, to do this really, to really put something forward that is on a mathematical level correct and leads to some attention on this level. So next slide, please. Thanks for your time. If you want to contact me or the Singular Institute, these are web pages. And if you're interested in helping, talking to me, or just straighting off into some philosophical discussion about this whole topic, I'm here. I will be here till the end of the Congress. And otherwise, write me a mail, visit the Singularity webpage, or talk to me after this lightning talks. Thanks.
All right, this is amazing. I think we have a presently unblemished record. Everybody has shown up for the past 2 hours and shown up exactly on time. That's, I think we can take 10 seconds to celebrate that. And also, I do have to apologize. I did not have time to correct that one statistic. So you can
No, it's fine. Don't worry. It's...
Okay, thanks. All right, I apologize.
So now something completely different. Women on Waves is a non-profit organization from the Netherlands that creates access to safe and legal abortion using different strategies. Next slide, please. It's one of the most performed medical procedures in the world, and about 48,000 women die because it's illegal in some countries. Next slide, please. This is the world map. The red and the pink countries are the countries where it's illegal, and the green countries is where it's legal, so there's a north-south difference. In Europe, it's still Poland, Ireland, and Malta. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to give you a short medical course, but I'm not going into details. These are medicines that are registered by the World Health Organization as essential medicines. Basically, medical abortion has changed the reality for women. It has made do-it-yourself abortions possible. Women don't need a doctor. It's the same as a miscarriage. It's very safe. Can I have the next slide, please? We are working to guarantee access to medical abortion because this is something women can do themselves. Can I next one? Next one. So it gives women the possibility to take their own lives in their own hands again. Can I have the next one? Next one. The strategies that we use, we have a ship that goes to countries where abortion is illegal. We support local groups to open hotlines, and we have an internet site called Women on Web where women can do an online consultation and they get the pill sent to their home address. Can I have the next slide? So this was a campaign in Portugal where we sent a ship, and the Minister of Defense decided that we were a threat to national security and stopped the ship with warships. Next slide. Fortunately, this led to the fall of the government and abortion. Abortion is now legal in Portugal. Can I have the next slide? We also won the European Court of Human Rights case that they violated our expression to freedom, freedom of expression. Next slide. So we learned from this during our last campaign in Morocco, where the ship was already laying in the harbor, and even though it was prepared through a secret Facebook group, which is not very safe, the security officers did not know the ship was already in the harbor, and some people really got shit for that. Next slide, please. So the safe abortion hotlines, these are now everywhere in South America. Next one. This was the launch of the one in Ecuador, which this is the Virgin of Quito. Next one. The way this one is in Chile. Next one. The way it's being distributed, the information is by stamping money. Next one. Hacking commercial boards. Next one. And of course, the media is very important. This never happened, by the way. We didn't have opposition. Next one. So Women on Web is a very important tool. We started in 2006. Next one. Next one. And women can go online and do an online consultation and get the pill sent to their home address. Currently, more than 6,000 women are being helped, and more than 100,000 emails per year in 11 different languages are answered by our help desk group. Next one, please. Of course, we have problems that the website is sometimes censored. Next one. We also have other censorship problems with Google, Facebook. Next one. These were the Google ads where we learned that they were not allowed anymore. Next one. Facebook took away my profile. whole picture. Next one. But they apologized, fortunately, because there were no naked breasts. Next one. So the other technique that we're using is augmented reality. This is a virtual banner hanging in front of the Vatican that says abortion pills are a gift from God. Next one. That's what, thank you.
Okay, not only was that presentation amazing, but nobody has gone through a deck that big that quickly in the history of lightning talks. And so in addition to all that, right, huge round of applause just for that. That was epic. And now we're not insanely ahead of time, still 2 minutes ahead of schedule, and all of the wonderful speakers just keep showing up. It's absolutely amazing. Are you ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, your 5 minutes starts now.
Okay. I want to quickly introduce the concept of data mining with malware, applying it to malware, specifically with a real-world example of applying this to PDF-based malware, and then hopefully taking this a bit further, having you guys take this a bit further to help go combat other file formats and apply this in other ways. Next slide. So the present problems that we currently have with malware, at least in the States, is that analysis of every single file does not scale. We get hundreds of thousands of files a day, all malicious or sometimes unclassified, and we're kind of confused with what to do with them. So we're wasting cycles processing every file. It ends up being a waste of time for all of our analysts, and we could be doing something else in the meantime. Also, binning malware by analysts is also often error-prone. Somebody may classify something different than another company, and thus they may duplicate efforts and, again, waste time. Next slide. So I wanted to introduce the concept of data mining, more or less extracting data from large data sets and then using that to build some sort of machine learning, using machine learning algorithms to then classify files whether or not they were malicious. So to do this, you have to take a PDF file format or the file format that you're performing this on and reduce it down to a simplistic vector. So this flat vector needs to be able to represent what a PDF is without actually being the PDF. So essentially what we're doing is we're teaching the computer what a good, bad, and targeted PDF looks like through this vector. So we represent what is a PDF in this very simplified format. So with this, we swap out features and algorithms until we get the desired results, which is we want to essentially classify unknown files and say this is malicious, this one's targeted, and this one's non-malicious. Next slide. So for this little experiment, these numbers are a little off, but the data set was 6,000 non-malicious PDFs, about, I think it was 15,000 malicious PDFs, and then a couple hundred targeted PDFs. Next slide. To actually begin this process in the data mining kind of cycle, you need to actually pick features. And features essentially are that part that make a PDF what a PDF is. So these are picked off of subject matter expertise. We use things like named dictionaries that was used in exploitation, things like JavaScript and whatnot. And then characteristics describing the file. How many objects were present? How large was the file? Was it malformed in any way? Did it follow the specification? And then we added and removed these features until we got the desired result of what it is that we wanted. In total, it was 35 features, and they looked like this. Next slide. In a tabular format, you essentially represent this data. Each line is a PDF, essentially, and it's more or less a vector of information. And those numbers, while they look like something out of the Matrix or, you know, nonsensical, they actually describe a good, bad, and targeted PDF. Next slide. So from this, with that information, I used open source libraries called Orange in Python, and we used known classification algorithms, Bayesian, k-nearest neighbor, SVM, and decision tree. To the right of each one of those algorithms is the actual, I would call it preliminary results of doing testing with the classifier. So essentially, I feed all the PDFs through that, and I say, you know, what is the accuracy of this? Did it properly find the malicious ones? Did it properly classify the non-malicious? And did it properly classify the targeted? So this was done through a 10-fold cross-validation method, which is a data mining technique to basically use your testing data as a way of validating your classifiers. And as you can see there, the results are pretty good. Next slide. So this is, it actually got tooled up in something I call a classy PDF, where essentially you can take a Python script and point it at a directory, and what it'll do is it'll give you this output, and you'll see it's pretty self-explanatory that it'll tell you whether or not the file is targeted, malicious or non-malicious, and then it'll give you a percentage of what the actual classifier deemed that as. Next slide. The practical use, this is implemented within the PDF X-ray toolset. It reduces the time spent looking at all of these files. Instead, you can run this tool against it and then find out whether or not something's malicious and if you want to look at it further. It helps identify potential targeted attacks, and it provides a percentage on classification to assist the user. Next slide. It's been added to the PDF X-ray API. Next slide. And in summary, data mining is good. The time investment is well worth the effort up front. It requires minimal tuning, and then you can apply general concepts and ideas to other problems and file formats. Good. Next slide.
And then just a quick reminder, as long as the presenters give permission, all of these slides are going to be available on the wiki after the Congress is over. We are now... Oh, Katie, thank you so much. God, I really, really needed this mate. And surprisingly, we are 2 minutes ahead of schedule. Thank you. You are absolutely amazing. I think I can still do this. We good? This is amazing. If the next three presenters show up, it will be a perfect round.
That's
an
really
absolutely
nice.
Perfect round. Round of applause for that real quick since we have the time. And go.
Shoy Rodo, I'm here to talk about Lojban. I'm Timo. And I'll start with, what is Lojban? Next slide, please. Lojban is a conlang, which stands for constructed language. It's not a programming language like you're used to, maybe. So it's used for speaking, people speaking to people, or people speaking to a computer, or a computer speaking to people. Next slide, please. And what is the purpose of this? I'm just going to tell you a few of the design goals for Lojban. Next slide, please. The first one is removing as much ambiguity from language as possible. And of course, removing semantic ambiguity is impossible, so we only do grammar and syntax unambiguously. Next slide, please. And this turns it into an awesome nerd toy, because we love stuff that's completely unambiguous, like programming language just can be parsed. Next slide, please. And Lojban has a context-free grammar, which is really awesome because it can easily be parsed by a computer, and you get a parse tree, and it's really nice. And on top of that, the grammar is really simple to learn. There are no conjugations, declinations, no word ever flexes, and it's really, really cool. Next slide, please. And another design goal is to create a language that is as culturally neutral as possible, so we don't have silly things like words that have genders, like in German, the word Mädchen, girl, is female, neutral. And such things. That's not in Lojban. And next slide, please. To create the vocabulary, we've devised an algorithm to use 6 most spoken source languages at the time to create words, which are Mandarin, English, Hindi, Arabic, Russian, and Spanish. Next slide, please. And this leads to a couple of easily recognizable words like birje for beer, karche for car, liste for list, dansu for dance, muche for much, and I guess you can guess what fofa is supposed to mean. Next slide, please. And it's called the logical languages. What does that even mean? Next slide, please. It means it's based on predicate logic. And one such predicate is nenri, which is the concept of something being inside something else. And let's construct a little example sentence from that. Next slide, please. What is a thing that usually has things in it? Well, a box, obviously. Lotanche. Next slide, please. And what do you usually find in such a box? Well, since this is the internet, of course, the answer is a cat. Lomlatu. Next slide, please. And these concepts very simply combine into a full sentence, Lomlatu ku nenri lotanche, which is just, the cat is in the box. Next slide, please. And Even though it's the logical language, it is very different from Vulkan, which is completely emotionless, because Lojban has a complete system for expressing your attitude and your emotions toward different parts of the sentence. So in this case, I've added three little parts. U is for love, like I love you. So in this case, I express my love for the cat. Zaha is an epistemological modifier which says, I know this from personal observation. So I know the cat is inside the box because I saw it maybe jump in or look out. And where Shuhi means, I'm not surprised about it being a box. Next slide, please. And of course, since we have a context-free grammar, this is the parse tree. It's colorful and simple and small. Sentences can get very complicated, nested, and with lots of extra stuff, so it becomes bigger, but the computer can still understand and parse it really, really fast. Next slide, please.
1 minute.
Okay, so how do you learn Lojban? Next slide, please. We have lessons on the RSC, Irshi, and our Mumble voice server. There's a document called the Wave Lessons, which is just because we made it on Google Wave, which is pretty new and pretty awesome, and there's Lojban for Beginners. Next slide, please. You can learn words using pre-made decks from Anki or Memrise. You can find them on the internet. They're awesome. Anki is for Windows, Mac, Linux, Android, and iOS, and Memrise is just a website. Next slide, please. And when you have learned Lojban, you can talk to people, or you could read one of those translations.
30 seconds.
Next slide, please. We have a complete translation of Alice in Wonderland, The Little Prince, and Kant's Metamorphosis. Next slide, please. Thank you. You can find me on Twitter at lolTimo, call me on deck 2303, or find me in front of the lecture hall or in the Entropia Assembly. Thank you very much.
If you'll allow me just to thank God for mate, I don't think I'd be able to survive without it. Other than that, Chad, are you ready to go?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, we're still surprisingly one minute ahead of schedule, and even though we are, I'm going to take this minute to say, even though this session is supposed to end at 1500, because we had lots of good submissions, we're actually going to go to 1510, if that's okay. So yes, that will be 2.5 hours of lightning talk, something that I'm not sure has ever been done before. But Chad, we're back on schedule. 5 minutes are yours, starting now.
Cool. Hi, I'm Chad. I'm from HeatSync Labs in Arizona, and I kind of have some obscure musical interests. I don't think musical harmony is mathematically rigorous enough, and as a consequence, I think modern musical tuning on like pianos and guitars is kind of garbage. So I have this weird problem where I want to go out in the world and I want to make music, but the instruments I want to use don't exist, so I have to make them myself. So I wanted to make this organ. It's going to be a bunch of keys. Next slide, please. The design features, I'll go in reverse order. I want to do 28 tones, which I decided, for reasons I won't elaborate on, 28 tones per octave that will be arranged in a grid, kind of like two dimensions, not like a line of keys on like a piano. I figured three octaves would be enough. I wanted a sine wave output, so you press the key and a corresponding sine wave tone comes out. And I wanted the keys to be volume sensitive, so maybe I could be a little bit louder if I hit it harder or something like that. Next slide, please. The key was the first thing I had to design. These are structures that the key that will hold the parts, the electrical and mechanical parts. One problem I ran into right away was that with an acoustic piano, you're kind of confined to a few centimeters wide, but you can put all the parts in as deep as you want. But when I'm doing a grid, I only have a few cubic centimeters to work with. So all the parts have to fit within this little kind of structure and has to be structurally sound. Another thing is they fit in next to each other to make the grid. Next slide, please. So I figured this is kind of experimental. The deeper you press it, the louder I wanted the output to get. So you push it down. There's some electronic and mechanical parts which will increase the volume. Next slide, please. The way my design was that there's a shaft underneath the button, and when you push it, it goes down. There would be a hole in it, but on one side of the hole would be an LED. But as the hole goes down, more light goes through, and I have a photoresistor which detects that change, and that resistance corresponds to a volume output. Next slide, please. This is just some pictures. You can see that the button on top, the shaft, all the parts, all the holes for the LED to fit into wires. Next slide, please. Here's another picture of them all fitting together. You can see the top part. They all fit together. They all have corresponding nooks and teeth that fit in. Next slide, please. Then I had to make the oscillator. And this is just kind of like needlessly painstaking the way I did it. I wanted to make 82 oscillators, which is kind of atypical. A lot of like really old like Moog synths, they just have one oscillator. But the advantage with 82 is I could play as many notes at the same time as I want. Another thing is a stable analog and sine is almost like a contradiction right away. I found some designs on the internet, and I'd make the sine wave oscillator and just be noise and constant, like constantly changing, not stable at all. But I cooperated with a guy who works next door to our hackerspace named Dean. Dean is a genius, and we came up with this oscillator that is just remarkably stable. Like, I don't even understand why it's so stable. We took a heat gun to it and just shot it at point blank, and it didn't seem to change. I tuned each one by hand, and they didn't change after that. They didn't drift or anything. Next slide, please. So here's how I organized it. I figured rather than just one board with 82 oscillators, I would just put them on smaller boards. These pots can change the tone and the volume, and they kind of tune it, adjust it, make it really, really clear and kind of a nice sound as opposed to distortion. Next slide, please. So this is how I decided to actually organize the instrument. Is I'd make modules of 2x6 keys, I think. Yeah, 2x6. And I would just stack them next to each other. And the fact that they're all flat, they could just be bundled together. And on top, you have kind of like a two dimensions of keys. So as you can see, the buttons are on top. Underneath that is the switches. Underneath that is the actual oscillators. And there's enough holes for wires to come in and out for power and the actual audio signal. Next slide, please. Yeah, here's just all the pieces fitting together. Everything just fits together really nice. It's really pleasant when that works out. A mix of acrylic and wood. Next slide, please. And here's just some rough buttons I made for just this mock-up. I'm not finished yet, but I have all the things together and they work, and that's kind of exciting. I spent about 3 months this summer just working on it nonstop, and then school started, so I kind of took a break. But I want to get back on this. And I hope I can do that next this upcoming summer. Next slide, please. So if you want to talk to me about this, you can email me, or you just find me some other time. I'll be wandering around. So thank you.
Oh, please don't fail now. Not now. Whew. Okay. Awesome. This is the second to last talk. We've got two more, and your 5 minutes starts now.
Hi, my name is Hubert. I work as a pen tester for a bank, and I'm a bit of an Apple fanboy. And my talk is about a tool I wrote called iSniff GPS. Slide, please. So in March this year, there was an interesting article on Ars Technica talking about an info leak issue affecting all iPhones. So it turns out when you connect an iPhone or an iPad to a Wi-Fi network, the device will sometimes send out ARP requests which disclose the MAC address of Wi-Fi routers that you've joined previously. Slide, please. So the article talked about how this is a big privacy issue and how you could, you know, by passive sniffing, you could find out where somebody lives. So I set out to write a little proof of concept tool that actually captures this information. And, you know, I wanted to look into whether you could actually do that. So the tool consists of two parts. There's a Python script, which uses Scapy to either sniff a live interface or read from a PCAP file. So I capture the client MAC addresses. I capture the ARP requests, which contain the information disclosure. I capture Bonjour broadcasts, which disclose the, you know, your Hubert's iPhone or whatever the name you set on your device. And I also capture standard 802.11 probe requests, so the requests that every Wi-Fi device sends out for previously joined networks. Slide, please. So this is just the output of running the Python script. You can see it's just gathering SSID probes, Bonjour broadcasts, and ARPs. Slide, please. So this is the Django web interface, which allows you to browse the information that the import script has collected. So I ran this for maybe half an hour at Black Hat in Vegas a couple of months ago, and there was a lot of traffic there. So I captured information about over 1,000 devices probing for 3,500 networks. Slide, please. So you can look at the information you collect grouped by network. So you can see there's about 600 devices that probe for the SSID Black Hat. You can look at get a list of specific clients that probe for one network. Slide, please. Now, clicking on a particular client that you've passively seen probing for networks, you can see this particular device, I think is an iPad, belonging to a friend of mine. It's probed for these SSIDs, and I've captured these two ARPs from it. So slide, please. So just given an SSID probe, which you know every laptop and every Wi-Fi device sends out SSIDs of networks you've previously joined. So just given those names, depending on the name, you can sometimes locate them quite precisely. So I mean, in the case of Black Hat, you know, there's a public website called Weigel.net, which is like a public open repository of war driving data. Anybody can submit to it. So if you have a unique SSID, you know, something not Netgear, you know, something more unique than that, you can sometimes get a location just from the SSID name. Slide, please. So more interestingly, if you capture one of these ARPs, which disclose the MAC address of a Wi-Fi router that the device is previously connected to, what can you do with that? So there's a number of companies that run geolocation databases, which provide a mapping from Wi-Fi router MAC addresses to GPS coordinates. So there's a company called Skyhook, which has been around for a number of years. They have a public API. Apple used to rely on Skyhook until 2010, and then Apple started running their own service. Google run a service like this, which is used on Android phones. They had some publicity recently saying people are saying this is a privacy risk. So Google have actually locked down the API. So you can't query a single MAC address anymore. You have to give two or more MAC addresses which are close to each other before Google will actually return a location. Slide, please. So Apple run their own Wi-Fi location service, which hasn't really been, there's not been a lot of disclosure about it. So every iPhone, by default, if you enable this option about sending diagnostics info, will contribute to Apple's database. So if you're just walking down the street, you know, without joining networks, your iPhone will submit information about the Wi-Fi routers it can see, and it'll send the GPS coordinates and the MAC addresses of those routers to Apple, so and you're helping Apple build that database. Slide, please.
1 minute.
So when you actually go into Google Maps on your iPhone and it's using Wi-Fi signals to get your location, this is actually what your iPhone sends to Apple. So your iPhone sends a list of saying, okay, these are the Wi-Fi router MAC addresses I can see near me, slide, and this is what comes back from Apple. So I found that you can actually send Apple a single MAC address of a Wi-Fi router, and they'll send back a result set of the GPS coordinates of that MAC address and 400 others. Slide, please. So if you've captured the single MAC address that
30 seconds
someone's phone's broke for, you can plug that into Apple service through SMT GPS, slide, and you can get very precise information back from that. So one more interesting thing, because Apple gives back the full MAC addresses, you can also tell the manufacturer from the OUI. So from the first three octets, you know, if you can get, you know, a dump of all the routers Apple has spidered in a certain area, and you can tell it's a D-Link device, it's an Apple device, and so on. So I'm going to do some more research on that and maybe submit a longer talk at a future conference. Thanks.
Wow. I actually think I let him go 10 seconds over because I forgot to give him his 10-second warning because I was like, what? So another amazing lightning talk. Tons of amazing lightning talks today. This is just absolutely incredible. And Kupo, you're here. Everybody showed up, and everybody showed up on time.
I better not mess this up, right?
This is amazing. All right, last one, and then we're out of here. Go, Kupo.
So, my name is Kupo, or Wo. You can just call me Jay if you want to see me around the conference. For the last year, I've been living in Iceland, and the scene on the ground is much more different than the scene that the press would have you believe. So right now in Iceland, a few interesting facts if you don't know about it. It's got about 300,000 people. It's about the size of Kentucky. It's got a very, very high literacy rate. It's got the third highest rank in happiness. It's got the most stable parliament. It was formed in 930. And the economy consists of smelting, tourism, and fishing. That's it. There are no real natural resources in Iceland except for one thing, electricity. It is an EEA member country. It is on the road to EU accession. It may happen, it may not. There are a lot of people that don't want to see it happen. So, what is IMI? Some of you may remember IMI from about 2 years ago. IMI is started out as the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, is now the International Modern Media Initiative. You may have seen Smali McCarthy walking around today. He's one of the co-founders of IMI. It covered a whole lot of areas and gaps in Icelandic legislation, and it was the aim was to provide the strongest freedom of speech and freedom of information legislation in the world. So far, it's doing okay. Friday, they passed a very big improvement to the Freedom of Information Act in Iceland, so that's very good. There's other stuff that still needs to be done. So no prior restraint needs to be established, protection of sources, protection of whistleblowers, and especially protection of libel lawsuits in Iceland. Slide. So, while we were there, we decided that in order to get IMI passed, and because there's a conservative government that's just itching to get back into power, that it was important for us to fight back on not just a technical and not just a legal, but a political level. So, we went ahead and formed the Icelandic Pirate Party, and that was on this past November. And we're doing quite well. We've got a pretty good following, and that we'll see. It requires some work, and it still requires a lot of information within Iceland, because a lot of people in Iceland have not heard of the Pirate Party, which is unusual. The parliamentarian Birgitta Jonsdottir from the movement, who was originally a WL person, is part of the Pirates, and we're putting together our policy framework. Typical Pirate Party politics, transparency, accountability, free direct democracy. We're aiming for 7.3% in the Althingi elections, the parliamentary elections in April, so keep your eyes on us. And we've done pretty well as far as building buzz and explaining to people in Iceland what pirates are about and why they should give a hoot about freedom of speech and especially freedom of speech online. Slide. So that's one part of the equation. The other part of the equation is Iceland and Iceland's infrastructure. Right now there's four submarine cables in Iceland. One is basically unusable. Three are okay, but run to non-low latency connections like Greenland or Denmark or Faroe Islands first. There is less than 3% of the cable capacity in Iceland right now being used, which is ridiculous because people are charging for tiered bandwidth internationally in Iceland. This, I hope, will change. Slide. Because this cable should be coming to Iceland within 2014. This is called Atlantic Emerald Express. Danice, the fastest cable connection to Iceland right now is 5 terabits a second. This is 50 terabits a second. It runs directly from Shirley, Long Island, New York, to Ireland, with a spur to Iceland. Slide. I beat myself. Okay. So pull me aside and talk to me if you want. My name's and my Twitter handle is there. If you want more information, go to Pirata or pirateparty.is. Thank you very much.
And ladies and gentlemen, that is our show. We had 2 hours and 25 minutes of lightning talks, and we ended exactly on time. This has been the most epic session of lightning talks ever. Let's beat it tomorrow. I will see you back here at 12:45. Thank you very much.